Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hey.
Hey, Corby. So I'm very relieved that the dock workers strike, longshoremen, is going to be delayed, I guess, until January, or they're going to keep things as they are until January, because I was afraid I was going to run out of bananas in like 2 weeks, which leads you to wonder that that's a very precarious place for our whole food system that imports a lot of fruits and vegetables to be. Is that the best
there's
we can
so
do?
There's so much precarious about bananas in particular, because the Cavendish is the name of the variety of bananas that are like 90% of all the bananas we eat and that are sold. And if something goes wrong or some invasive insect comes in and wrecks the Cavendish, you know, which is big, easy to peel, tastes good, then the whole banana industry is completely up a tree, so to speak. So the problem with the longshoremen strike is that 75% of bananas, I think, came through Baltimore and Eastern Seaboard ports. That was the problem. And also an enormous amount of coffee. So the problem was breakfast. It was bananas and coffee. And there are these choke points. And if there's enough warning of a strike in advance, different shippers and Walmart and other companies can start trying to redirect shipments to the West Coast, to other main ports of entry. But, you know, it takes weeks and months to turn around. And in the meantime, scarcity would begin, but more than that, prices would go up.
But isn't there like a cautionary tale in this? Not just what's our temporary fix when there's a strike on one or two coasts, but not on another. It's sort of, I was wondering if it's analogous. Remember when microchips, big nightmare during COVID, and then all of a sudden we had the CHIPS Act and everything else, thanks to the former Rhode Island governor and President Biden, that allows for a lot of manufacturing being started here, including in places like Ohio and other kinds of things. Is there any long-term plan that would allow businesses and in turn their customers who are dependent on perishable food kinds of things to not fall victim to the decision that when an employer and the Longshoremen's Union can't come to agreement?
I have to take the right-minded foodie answer, which is stop eating bananas and things that don't grow in this country.
Well, that's a good
and
answer.
Stop being so reliant on coffee. Because, you know, Vinland, I think, was the name of the terrific Portland, Maine restaurant that insisted on serving only food that was grown in New England. There was this movement for a while. Remember locavores? When's the last time you called yourself a locavore, Jim? You might have to start doing that again. So caffeine becomes a problem, but you just do without lemons. You know, that you can. There's plenty of lemons in California and Florida. But coffee and most tea, not all tea, and bananas, you're right, you're just not going to have them.
By the way, if I knew what a locavore was, I'd call myself that. That's one. Two, I've told you the story before, but it's relevant now. I was at a Farm Aid concert a couple of years ago, and people know one of the board members is Neil Young, who's very political. And Neil Young, in the middle of his set, started talking, as he always does, and dropped about 4,000 F-bombs on people, saying, if the effing people in this audience don't end up buying every effing piece of food they eat from a family farm or a farm stand, then you're not welcome at our concerts or some such thing. It was fabulous. It was so fabulous. And he made the case with great detail that virtually everything, maybe not coffee, virtually everything that you consume is available in those sort of settings. Do you buy that?
Are you sure he didn't use the L word, locavore?
Wait a minute. You just kind of freaked me out there. You said that we shouldn't be eating bananas because we can't grow them locally. I thought there were different versions of bananas that at least could be American grown. No?
You sound like you're in agony.
Because I love bananas.
Well, you know, Marjorie, it's because you're spoiled.
Marjorie, okay. I love liverwurst. I've got a problem,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, liverwurst.
Speaking
oh, my
of that,
God.
You know what the most troubling...
All we've heard about in this show, behind the scenes, for like 2 weeks, is liverwurst.
Okay, we're going to hear about it again.
We're going to hear about it some more. Now, go ahead, Jim.
We know that's what prompted the shutting of this huge Boar's Head plant. But, you know, I hadn't read backstories until last night. And, by the way, you weren't listening to the earlier part of the show. But someone just made a note to call our colleague, said that Mike Lindell is selling local bananas. Which,
yeah, Mr. Pillow guy.
Mr. Pillow, okay, but I'm sorry I haven't read that. In any case, the horrifying part of the story, which I'd never read, until last night, I'm embarrassed to say, I think it was in the Washington Post, but I'm sure it's been everywhere, is yet again, the federal food inspectors knew what a cesspool this plant was. Repeatedly, they visited. They saw mold. They saw leaking on open hams and all this sort of stuff. And they didn't do a damn thing. So while so many of us are addressing, and I'm sure the families of those people who died from listeria because of the contaminated liverwurst, they're upset with Boar's Head, as they should be. The government failed us too, didn't it, Corby?
First of all, none of us knew this story until last night or September 30th when the Washington Post published a long, really impressive investigative piece of journalism that there was dozens of interviews with people. They often showed up at the plant in Virginia and were escorted off the premises by security. You're not welcome here. So we didn't know just how bad it was with black mold, with clear liquid dripping from the ceilings and being sprayed by fans across food. So it's shocking, the conditions of that plant. It really makes me rethink everything about Boar's Head, especially hearing about a whistleblowing inspector who was an internal plant worker who was fired, obviously not for cause, but because he was making trouble. And Boar's Head is, you know, a very thin, implausible claim about why they fired this guy. So it really makes me think about Boar's Head. But you, Jim, are right to say, why doesn't the USDA have more enforcement and authority? And that's because the laws have, for the past 40 or 50 years, favored industry and said, industry can do voluntary compliance. They can run their safety checks and give us the paperwork. But as you might have noticed in this story, some of the paperwork was very disturbing. There are supposedly new algorithms that are supposed to flag this. They didn't. It takes months to get around to this. And the USDA, which was the regulator here of record, did not impose sanitation and pasteurization and some much harder and more expensive rules. They kept saying, you know, try to keep things clean and give us a report every couple months.
Well, then can I say one more thing about this, if I may? This relates to the despicable Ralph DeLaTorre with Steward, who I believe is responsible for the death of people, the Sackler family, who are responsible for the death of thousands of people. The people who run Boar's Head, it is not credible to believe that the executives did not know of the conditions that you describe. And if they allowed the conditions to continue because they wanted to make sure they kept selling liverwurst and ham to make money, then the families whose loved ones died, there should be criminal charges against these executives. They essentially executed. I mean, they're responsible for the deaths of these people. Is that not a fair statement?
Well, of course. And remember the peanut plant in, was it Georgia, where there were criminal charges finally? But it took years. This was an executive who knowingly killed people. And I think it was listeria also. I think it was listeria and peanuts. But that Boar's Head was willing to turn a blind eye and fire a whistleblower has made me think very differently from Boar's Head. And I had a high opinion of it.
So
you know, one of the things that has not gotten that much publicity from Project 2025 is talking about diminishing the power of agencies like the FDA. Like the Weather, NOAA, all those regulatory agencies, which is a very scary thing, because if you think that your food, there's no way to know whether your food is safe now, I can't imagine what this will mean going down the road. And it's all a result of big money in politics and lobbyists and these industry leaders paying all this money to politicians to vote against strengthening the rules. And you know, when you look at Europe and you compare Europe to us, I mean, they are so far ahead of us in this kind of thing. It's really painful.
But it's not only that. Even when the Obama administration did pass a long festering and in the works Food Safety Modernization Act, they did. It's never been funded by Congress. So even if you win the battle and finally move something to Congress that's supposed to make food safer, that was the FDA, which doesn't regulate meat. USDA regulates fresh meat. If Congress doesn't fund it, they're still powerless.
Yeah, it's really, I've said a million times, I think Americans, we're really suckers in a way. We just let big industry get away with it.
Well, it's another reason why Neil Young is right. It's not just because of the situation about importing food from elsewhere. But eating food that's manufactured in these mega companies, you can't trust if it's safe.
Well, here's another really depressing story. I'm sorry to be so downbeat here, but this is out of New Hampshire, Durham, New Hampshire. The New York Times reported about this family where the children were getting sick from so-called forever chemicals on the farm up there.
It's a terrible story, and it shows you that even buying local, you can be dinged. And here's the buying local. There's a wonderful family organic farm. I think their name is Dosti, raising beef and cattle and cows for milk that they sold to Stonyfield Farm, which only buys organic milk and is a great supporter of local New England dairies, also in trying to save many endangered family farms in New England. So in 2020, the family got a call saying, you have a lot of PFAS, P-F-A-S, these forever chemicals in your milk, and we can't buy them anymore, sorry. So the daughter-in-law of this family, who lives in Durham, New Hampshire, thought, sickeningly, my two young children have unusually high cholesterol levels. They're under 10, and they're not responding all that well to vaccines. Those are two of the most noteworthy side effects of ingesting too many of these forever chemicals. And it turned out it was because beef they were getting and eating from this main family farm, as well as milk, were full of these chemicals. And they thought these are the safest thing ever. They're our family. They're organically grown. What they didn't know is that sewage sludge, legal to use as fertilizer, had been spread all over the family land in Maine in the 80s and early 90s. So decades before, and that's what forever chemicals means. They haven't gone away. So that land can never be farmed again.
And we've heard about this going on out in the Maine places where we get beef and cattle from in the Midwest. This is going on all around the country, this fertilizer sludge that's contaminated with different kinds of chemicals. I mean, this is a huge problem for the food supply.
It goes into water, too. So PFAS are still around, and they're not as heavily regulated as they should be. There was a related one, PFOS, PFOS, F-O-S, that has been banned, and so those levels are going down. But it's time to take much stronger action against PFAS.
So by the way, there's a national organization, I just want to say, it doesn't deal with the food part of PFAS stuff, but deals with, like, household products that you have under your counter at home, Silent Spring. You should check them out. They do wonderful work.
They've talked about the link between chemicals and breast cancer.
Yeah. So there's a story in the New York Times from April 11th that people should check out. Forever chemicals are everywhere. Here's how to limit your exposure. And the first piece of advice, I think, is a little hard to comply. It says, don't eat or drink anything, which is really, that's hard.
But aside from that.
No, here, listen to this. By the way, I didn't know this. I bet you most people here. Did you people know that nonstick cookware is a real? Well, you're not. A lot of people are not. I didn't. I use nonstick and I use cast iron too.
Well,
but you shouldn't use nonstick at all.
You're walking PFAS now, then, Jim.
I mean, that's horrible. They say use cast iron, stainless steel, etc. Water filters. Please. Avoid textiles. This I knew, that say they're waterproof and stainproof, but don't claim to be PFAS free. I'm sorry.
Limit your use of so-called combustible dinnerware. Those are bad too.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm the hugest fan of the writer of this article we're quoting from, Joe Fassler, because he actually broke this story. And he did most of the reporting that sounded alarms about PFAS in food products and food storage containers. So every couple of months, we just have to have a new reason to remind Jim, nonstick cookware, they're in raincoats. It's waterproof stuff. So think of anything that's waterproof as being probably dangerous.
Is there nonstick cookware, I assume some, that says affirmatively there are no PFAS, no forever chemicals in there?
I haven't seen that, and that's a very good thought, but I think you just need to sharpen up your elbow grease and get a lot of barkeeper's friends.
Yeah, and use a lot more nonstick spray or a nonstick spray.
Well, you don't have to use spray on cast iron. I never used a cast iron pot till 10 years ago. It's one of the greatest things.
Stainless steel. If you're making like fried eggs or something like that. Or you
cast iron is great. And you can season it and it becomes nonstick, your homemade nonstick cookware.
Yeah, aren't you not? You're only supposed to clean cast iron certain ways, right?
You don't use soap and whatever. You just use hot water and you scrub it. And then you dry it on the fire and then you oil it, which is that's what the seasoning is, right? The oiling of it at the end of the thing? Hello?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Also, you can leave it in a very low oven overnight, or that's probably the safest way. But also, coarse salt, you can use that to brush out food that's stuck.
Okay, so can we talk about a I don't know if it's upbeat.
Yeah, we need something upbeat.
But when you're
here.
A politician, by the way, you know, this story that we read about politicians, you know, eat food
story.
Everywhere. This is in the Washington Post, the title of which is The Delicate Art of the Campaign Trail Restaurant Visit. They stated something that was so obvious to me, but then I realized maybe it's not obvious to everybody. Do you know why politicians do all this food eating in local restaurants and pizza parlors and, in case of J.D. Vance, attempting to eat a donut in a donut shop?
I have no idea. One
because
of the guys?
That's what real... No, exactly.
One of the
it's
guys.
It's what real people do.
Yep.
They go to... So
they
it's the pizza. Only... You know, it's not a speech. It's not a highfalutin thing. It's an opportunity to show that you're sort of like real people. Now, here's J.D. Vance. He had a little bit of a hard time. Surrounded by a camera crew, walking into a donut shop a couple of weeks ago, trying to pour on that Appalachian charm. Here he is.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, good.
Good, good. The zoo has come to town.
I'm sorry,
babe? Okay, yeah. She doesn't want to be on film, guys, so just cut her out of anything. Appreciate that, man. I'm J.D. Vance. I'm running for vice president. Good to see you.
Okay.
That and, by the way, I have to say, even though he's clumsy, in this one case, I feel bad for
so
him.
So do I.
If you don't do advance work, your team to say they're happy to have you, and that, which is obviously what you should do. You shouldn't just walk in with cameras to somebody's donut shop. I'm J.D. Vance. I'm running for vice president. Okay.
I don't want to be in film. Get away from me.
So as a food writer extraordinaire, this has been going on since time began, right?
Right. I mean, what was good about this piece is that it was saying the only relatable activity that most candidates can ever even try to perform is eating in a local restaurant and eating what people have. But if you don't have your advance people or yourself talking to the owner and saying, what's your most popular item? What do I need to have before I go? What do you want me to have? That was one of the ironclad rules of, there were actually two stories about food and campaign visits, and the other one was never eat on camera. Never allow anyone to show you eating. Eat it, take it away because your campaign is just too rushed. Go in and make nice with people and talk to them about their great lobster roll or jelly donut or cruller or whatever it is, but don't eat it because you'll always be dinged because you'll do it wrong.
Okay. How many people in the audience have ever had a cheesesteak in Philadelphia? Okay, not many, like five. What kind of cheese? Yell out, what kind of cheese are you supposed to have on a cheesesteak? Do you know in Philly? You got Cheese Whiz. That's what you're supposed to have. Who is the politician running for president, who I admire, who went to my hometown of Philadelphia, ordered a cheesesteak from the two famous place, and said, I'll have Swiss on my cheesesteak.
And Therese will have Swiss
now
as well.
Now you gave it away. She was not there. That was Secretary of State John Kerry. If you make a mistake like that, and who was the other? We know John Kasich, who ran for president, cut his pizza with a knife and a fork in New York City.
Yeah, I didn't think that was so bad.
That is...
De Blasio.
De Blasio? Oh, because he's from Cambridge, not New York. He didn't know. Right, exactly.
Sometimes it's really messy.
That, he said, my family's Italian, and they eat it in Avellino, or I don't think they're from Avellino, but the southern Italy, with a knife and fork. So excuse me, I can do that. It didn't help.
Yeah, so here's the question about pizza. Do you have to eat it flat, or can you kind of
fold
it?
That's a good question.
But again, this depends on what area of New York you're in.
Okay.
Older Boston, some fold, some don't, and you're just going to get in trouble. You're going to do it wrong whichever way you try.
Okay. Well, they have to be very, very careful. I guess things did not go that well for poor JD at the donut shop.
No, but it's advance work. You're supposed to do advance work. So that's, I don't know if that's good news, but it's interesting news, and that's why they eat. And you can see him on television because you eat, which is one of the few things that you and... By the way, Tim Walz, did you see right after the debate walked down the street?
He went to a pizza joint, yeah.
Went to a pizza joint in New York City after the debate.
Well, I think he was recovering from the debate. That was a difficult night for him.
You know, before you go, one last piece of bad news, and then we're going to dismiss you, Corby. Is SNAP benefits are still being held captive in this farm bill. And I think you've told us in the past, in the old days, even in partisan days, one of the few things that Democrats and Republicans could unite on was farm bills. And obviously, those days are long gone by. Are food stamp programs for low and moderate income people at risk here?
They are. If the farm bill, which is already a year overdue and got continued for a year but with no changes in funding at all, that was the deal to keep it going. If a new bill is not passed by December, that means that as of February, SNAP benefits can start being radically reduced because they continue for a month after the end of the bill, and the end of the current extension is the end of December. So the fragile but firm coalition that has ironically always kept SNAP benefits going is that urban politicians need them because so many of their constituents are on food stamps, and rural people need large votes from urban centers, so they would agree to this. Whereas what they all, the only thing they really care about are big industrial farms and subsidized crop insurance, which is the main farm bill funding for farmers. It's not the crop subsidies that are so notorious, it's crop insurance. But again, that's not for food crops, that's for cotton and soy and things that aren't, soy is not used for food, it's used for animal feed. And for ethanol. So this is held together, but I don't see any progress toward getting this passed by the end of December with the election coming. So it's going to be a high wire act.
We'll talk to you more about it in the weeks ahead. Corby Cummer, it's great to see you. Thanks so much for your time.
And you.
Thank you very
and
much,
you.
Corby Cummer. We've been speaking with Corby Cummer, a multiple James Bing Award winner, executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. So a little behind the scenes here. We debated whether or not to do this next one because it is lunchtime. We didn't want to upset people too much.